turmoil in Hong Kong has protesters asking themselves about violent tactics.
I would not say I'm not afraid. It would be a lie if I said I'm not afraid at all. But I would be more afraid if Hong Kong people give up.
Violence has people in Hong Kong asking yet again, is this a turning point? I'm Marco Werman. Also in the grip of massive popular protests, Bolivia. President Evo Morales may have resigned, but his supporters are not backing down.
They are not going to accept the resignation of Evo Morales, and they are calling for a civil war.
And in Germany, luxury tax includes tampons.
The state is telling me your menstruation is not worth it, and you as women are not worth it.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Veterans Day. Violent protests today in Hong Kong left at least two people in critical condition. Two different and disturbing scenes were captured in videos posted online. In one, a black-clad protester was shot at close range by a police officer. And earlier in the day, a man said to be a Chinese government supporter was doused in some kind of flammable liquid and set on fire after an argument with protesters. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam spoke at a news conference today and said that protesters have crossed a line. The actions by rioters have far exceeded the call for democracy, Lam said. They are now the enemy of the people. And while Hong Kong activists see themselves as defenders of the people, they're having an intense debate about what sorts of tactics they should be using. Casey Wong is a visual artist and an educator who's been out in the streets supporting the protests.
5 years ago, we're seeing the traditional civil disobedience, which is kind of like Martin Luther King, Gandhi style of protest, which is you break the law and then you sit and wait for the police to come and catch you. Now we are into the new era of uncivil disobedience.
So just clarify, do you feel like violence needs to be a tool now in the toolbox in addition to these other nonviolent strategies?
Violence is a tool. It's like calling a martial artist a violent person. Somebody actually asked Bruce Lee, you know, if somebody punched him in the face, what would he do? You know, he answered by, if somebody punched me in the face, I'll take it as a question. You know, I'll either block it or punch back.
But will punching back work? Pro-democracy leader Agnes Chow in Hong Kong says among the protesters, there's a range of opinions.
In this protest, there are no leaders, so all participants of the protest always discuss strategy on the internet, usually on internet forum and also in social media. So, of course, there are also a lot of debates. But when the government show no respect to public opinion after we use peaceful way, even we have 2 million Hong Kong people, that is a quarter of the population of Hong Kong on the street. When the government show no respect to public opinion, more and more people, even not only young people, but a lot of people who used to support peaceful way, they started to support more radical ways to impose more pressure to the government.
Agnes, aren't you worried about being on the streets of Hong Kong given the increase in violence and all these suspicions about who's out there?
Confronting such a strong and powerful regime and confronting police who would always abuse their power and torture normal citizens, I would not say I'm not afraid. It would be a lie if I said I'm not afraid at all. But I would be more afraid if Hong Kong people give up. I'll be more afraid if we lose freedom, if we lose our home, because I could see many young people on the front line using their bravery, using their courage to fight for the freedom of Hong Kong. And they are ready to sacrifice even their life to fight for a better future for Hong Kong. If Hong Kong people give up, Hong Kong would definitely become a police state, and there will be no freedom, no human right, no one country, two system in Hong Kong, and it would not be Hong Kong anymore.
So I hear your determination, Agnes, and yet surrounding you, like earlier today, this stunning drama where a pro-Beijing supporter was doused in some kind of flammable liquid set on fire after an argument with protesters. I mean, things are getting really, really tense. What is your biggest worry right now?
some behavior from the protesters' side are sometimes not proportional, and there are a lot of discussion and debates about it already on the internet forum, and many protesters are trying to improve next time. But I just hope that people would also see the real violence is from the regime, that they try to use the power, they try to use money, they try to use violence to suppress all of the democratic ideas in Hong Kong. It makes a lot of Hong Kong people very angry. That's why they have such hatred towards police or people who are supporting police. But there are still a lot of debates and discussion on the internet about that behavior, and I hope that we could improve together.
Hong Kong pro-democracy activist Agnes Chow, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Now to Bolivia, where street protests against President Evo Morales erupted 3 weeks ago after the opposition claimed he rigged a presidential election. Last night, Morales resigned after 14 years in power. What followed were celebrations and fireworks, but also roadblocks, street violence, and arson. President Trump today said events in Bolivia send a message to illegitimate regimes in other parts of Latin America. But right now, it's a confusing picture in Bolivia. Morales quit after the army said it could no longer support him. Some of his supporters are refusing to recognize the president's resignation. Carmen Solis is from Bolivia and now teaches history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte.
I think we need to be worried. On the one hand, what you could see yesterday was a lot of people who was against Evo Morales were celebrating in the streets. So you saw a lot of celebrations. And at night, supporters of Evo Morales kind of started some vandalism in the city, in La Paz City. And right now, the last thing that I hear is that his supporters in Cochabamba, the coca growers, have decided that they are not going to accept the resignation of Evo Morales, and they are calling for a civil war.
A possible civil war? I mean, how realistic is that?
Well, I have to say, and just to international ears, that sometimes Bolivians' rhetoric tends to be a lot more radical than our actions. I hope that is always the case, but we tend to make these massive claims and then things somehow get solved. So I hope that this is going to be the case, that everyone is going to, there are a lot of groups that are making very radical claims, but somehow we're going to find a channel, a non-violent channel to get out of this crisis.
So Carmen, your mother still lives in La Paz, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
How is she handling all of this?
Well, she has been following the news. I've been talking to her like 3 times a day at least, and that's a very good way to know what's happening in the country. Mm. And
we've heard about water and power blackouts. Is she coping all right?
Well, what happened, and here everything that happens is some kind of is related to the past. So you want to know that La Paz City is like a canyon, and 200 years ago, 1781, indigenous protest against colonial power, against the Spaniards, sieged the city, and they did not allow water, and they did not allow provisions to get into the city. And since then, this form of protest has been kind of been reenacted many, many times. The first thing that people does is siege the city and cut water and cut services. Last night, my mom told me that that there's no water, but no problem. We've been through this. I'm going to sleep. Basically, that's what she told me. And in the morning, water was already restored, and the police had went back to the streets. So far, things somehow calmed down in La Paz. But I read in the news that there were confrontations in El Alto of people against Evo and people pro Evo.
So police are in the streets around the country, also in neighborhoods. I've been hearing about these groups that it's kind of a neighborhood watch, not quite vigilante, but they're security, right? I mean, who are these people? Because they're kind of trying to protect their neighborhoods from violence and intruders.
Well, the comités, juntas vecinales, these neighborhood councils are really strong everywhere in the country. And the most important neighborhood council, they were the ones who are leading the protest pro Evo. And in response to that, people, for example, in the neighborhood of my mom was telling me that last night people was walking in the neighborhood and they organized and they were trying to double check that everything will be okay in my neighborhood. And of course, that was happening because these protesters put on fire a lot of houses. They were targeting people who was against Evo Morales, that are well known for their voices against Evo Morales.
Carmen Solis, originally from Bolivia, now teaching at UNC Charlotte. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Over the weekend, Canada was suddenly consumed by a conversation about patriotism and immigration. It kicked off when a longtime Canadian hockey commentator shocked some fans in a rant on television. The world's Rupa Shenoy has more.
In the U.S., it's Veterans Day. In the U.K., it's Armistice Day. And up north in Canada, it's called Remembrance Day. Canadians traditionally mark the day by wearing a symbol of the Royal Canadian Legion. It's a blood-red poppy pin that represents those who've fallen in wars. Former player, coach, and longtime hockey commentator Don Cherry was wearing one of those pins on Saturday during his regular segment on the show Hockey Night in Canada. And he complained that he doesn't see many immigrants honoring those who served.
You people love, you that come here, whatever it is, you love our way of life, you love our milk and honey. At least you could pay a couple of bucks for poppies or something like that. These guys pay for your way of life that you enjoy in Canada. These guys paid the biggest price.
The reaction to Cherry's comments came fast. His words, "you people," became a trending hashtag on Twitter. The Canadian Broadcast Standards Council said it was overwhelmed by complaints. People called 85-year-old Cherry xenophobic and anti-immigrant and said he should be fired. Former candidate for Prime Minister Jagmeet Singh tweeted a picture of his great-grandfather who fought for the British in World Wars I and II. Indian-Canadian Harpreet Saini's grandfather also fought in World War II. Saini told Canada's Global News that Cherry shouldn't be equating poppy wearing with patriotism.
He was targeting not only immigrants, but especially immigrants of color. I think that Mr. Cherry fails to understand the impact and the contribution of immigrants, not just in Canada, but around the world, not just in today, but throughout Canada's military history as well.
The National Hockey League condemned Cherry's comments, and the president of the TV network Sportsnet released a statement that said Cherry's comments were discriminatory and offensive, and that they'd spoken with Cherry about the severity of the issue. Hockey Night in Canada host Ron McLean apologized to viewers Sunday. He had sat by Cherry as he made his comments and briefly flashed a thumbs up.
I owe you an apology, too. That's the big thing that I want to emphasize. I sat there. Did not catch it, did not respond.
Cherry hasn't apologized, and he has a history of making controversial comments, supporting hockey fighting, complaining about female sports reporters and dressing rooms, and about French Canadians in general. This weekend, Cherry's defenders argued the reaction to his most recent comments were overblown. Guidi Maman, a Toronto immigration lawyer, told Global News that he supports Cherry's free speech.
And if he said, "you people," that would include me. I'm an immigrant to this country. I take no offense to it whatsoever. And I think people who are taking offense, I think it's ridiculous.
But some say Cherry's comments could alienate future players. The National Governing Body for Hockey in Canada says fewer kids are joining their youth programs. It's trying to attract more immigrant children to the sport. Gurpreet Dhillon, a Brampton, Ontario city councillor, told the CBC, hockey hasn't been welcoming in the past.
I had to go through a lot of racism when I was just learning how to skate, and so I kind of gave up on it. And so I don't want to see that to happen to my son.
Dhillon said this Cherry incident could be an opportunity.
If there was some type of round table going forward where we have members of the community there, if we have Mr. Cherry there, we have the NHL there, we could really find out how we can, you know, not only express our patriotism, but we can talk about how we can grow the game of hockey.
Sportsnet, the network, appears to agree. It announced today that Don Cherry would step down immediately from the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. November 11th, 11/11, as we just heard, it's Armistice Day in many countries, Veterans Day here in the U.S., of course. In China, it's something else, Singles Day. If the number 1 symbolizes being alone, then 11/11 is the quintessence of being single, so you treat yourself to something luxurious. 11/11, no surprise, is also one of China's biggest shopping days of the year. With all that shopping comes a lot of packaging waste. You know what I'm talking about. You buy a tiny item online, and it shows up in a massive box. That's e-commerce waste, and it has environmentalists worried. Haichong Jia is the director of the Packaging Engineering Program at Rutgers University. And first off, what is it that packaging engineering professors do exactly?
We educate our students doing a good packaging, and also we educate our students to consider sustainability, and then all the other things related to packaging, the material engineering, manufacturing, and distribution, and everything else.
Yes, so on a big day like Singles Day in China, we got to think about sustainability, and you're a good one to ask about e-commerce waste. E-commerce waste, this phrase gets thrown around a lot. What exactly does that mean?
When we purchase a thing from a retail store, we directly get the package, the retail package. But if you don't have a special e-commerce package, when you order anything online, they have to put an overall box on the top of the retail package, which that generates a lot of waste.
Right. So you've got the packaging the item is put into for marketing, and then you've got the box for shipping. What has to happen to reduce all this e-commerce waste?
People try to reduce the package size. I think one thing, though, is very important. Instead of shipping the retail product or retail package, they have to redesign a package for e-commerce. So which means the package itself can be shipped directly without the overbox, which will reduce a lot of unnecessary waste during shipment. But on the top of that, there's a trend now, which I think just started to get people's attention, is about returns. When we order things from the e-commerce, we get it in, and then very often we don't like it, we have to return it. And when we do return, what do? You put it in a box and then seal the box and ship it back. So it's like a double waste.
So aside from being good stewards of the environment, what incentives do companies have to reduce their own e-commerce waste?
This actually can reduce their cost. Because shipping cost is considered a lot for the e-commerce transaction. And then if you can ship multiple things in one box or in one shipment, you actually can reduce your own shipping cost, because a lot of companies nowadays, they offer free shipping and free return. So all this cost actually is on them. It's not on consumer. So they have a reason they want to reduce those waste on their own.
And aside from recycling, Professor, I mean, what else can consumers do about e-commerce waste?
They are actually the driving force, for sustainable packaging. If they put their voice up, say they want to have a better package, not just shipping a big box with a lot of air pocket or waste inside. I think company will do that, because that will help them to increase their sales. So I think consumer will drive the company, and the company will see this is a benefit for them, and they will do it.
Haichong Jia, the director of the Packaging Engineering Program at Rutgers University. I never thought talking about waste would be so fascinating, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
When you hear the phrase luxury tax, what comes to mind? Cognac, cigars, designer handbags maybe? What about tampons? Well, that's how menstrual products were categorized in Germany until recently. No longer a luxury, though, thanks to activists like Nana Josephine Roloff. She helped write the online petition that got German lawmakers to change the tax. I asked Nana if this is a big win for Germany.
Absolutely. This was a very great day. It was a historical day. We are talking about female health and how we want this state to be and how we want our tax system to be. So we opened a door to a greater topic.
So Germany at one point decided that menstrual products were luxury items, and looking at fresh cut flowers and live goldfish as everyday essentials, taxed at a lower rate of 7%. How did that make you feel?
How did it make me feel? I felt oppressed, something like that. Like somebody's telling me, the state is telling me, your menstruation is not worth it. And what comes with it is you as women are not worth it. And we don't see that your period is any of our business. And that's wrong. Our menstruation gives life. And without it, there wouldn't be any of us. So it is definitely a topic that should be more public, that we should talk more about. And to give it some respect. Yeah.
I'm just curious, why not just remove the tax altogether on tampons? Why is there still a tax at all?
We have a different system over here, so this might sound strange, but in Germany, we actually like to pay taxes. Because with these taxes, we finance our welfare state system. We didn't see any chance to cut the tax completely. The state needs these taxes to work like it is, like it does.
And Nana, how did you get involved in this whole movement to eliminate the luxury tax on tampon products?
I was not alone in this. So with my friend Jasmine, when we found out that these supplies are on a higher tax rate than flowers and caviar, even caviar is a lower tax.
Really?
Yes, really. We just found it unfair. And we started this petition online on change.org. And they were very supportive. And so we started to do some research and connect us.
So you basically educated yourself on the tax on menstrual products and got outraged.
Yes, really. I searched the whole internet about who decided that, when did they decided that, why did they decided it?
And what did you learn? I mean, why was this tax started in the first place?
Basically, because the people who decided this weren't on their days, so because they don't get the days, because most of them were men.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, I don't even want to talk about that about them, but when you don't have your period, you can't imagine how it must be for people to suffer, to go through this every month. It's just not in their mind. It wasn't in their mind. So they decided, yeah, that's not a basic essential. You don't need that every day. And that really was an argument, right? Some people just came there. Yeah, you just don't, you don't need that every day. You just need it 5 days in a month.
So it sounds like your work is not complete yet.
No, we will keep our fight up. So the next thing we want to do is to get menstrual products into public spaces. We want menstrual products to be on the same level as toilet paper. Nobody expects me to bring my toilet paper when I go into a public toilet room.
Nana Josephine Roloff, one of the activists behind the petition to lower Germany's tax on menstrual products, which German lawmakers did this month. Nana, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You're with theworld.org, and on your radio, it's The World. DACA gave undocumented immigrants a little protection, but not enough for Karen Hernandez.
I eventually want to have kids, you know, and I couldn't see that happening in the States because worrying all the time that one day I might not be able to work.
She moved to Canada while her sister stayed in the U.S. One family's DACA story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Tomorrow is one of the biggest days on the Supreme Court's calendar this year. The court is considering the Trump administration's decision to end the Obama-era program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It provides some legal protections for undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. Nearly 700,000 people have DACA status. We'll hear more about the legal case in a few minutes, but first, The World's Monica Campbell has a story of one family that's closely watching the fate of DACA.
My name is Angela Luz Maria Hernandez Velasquez. So I have a lot of names. And I'm 26.
I'm Karen Hernandez. I'm 31 years old.
Angela and Karen are sisters. And one day, in the late 90s, their parents told their family to pack up. They were leaving Guatemala and going to California. The kids thought it'd be a short stay, but months became years.
We stopped asking when we were going back because we figured probably weren't going to go back to Guatemala anymore.
The United States was a place where their dad could earn more. It also meant stability. Guatemala was still recovering from a civil war. But the tourist visas they all arrived on expired. Everyone was undocumented, and that complicated things. After Karen, the oldest, went to college and got a degree in economics, she couldn't work legally without a social security number.
So what am I going to do with my college degree? I started doing babysitting and, you know, those type of jobs. My mom cleaned houses, so that's I helped.
That's how it went for years, working for cash and worrying that a wrong move could lead to deportation. Then, in June 2012, President Obama used an executive order to launch the DACA program. It offered people like Karen and Angela, brought to the U.S. as kids, temporary relief from deportation and a work permit. The sisters applied right away. Here's Angela.
I took advantage of the opportunity as soon as it came out. I was like, okay, well, this is my chance.
She got a retail job at a Bath and Body Works store that helped pay for college. Then she worked at an insurance company. For Karen, DACA helped her work too and get a master's degree. Then in 2017, President Trump canceled DACA.
I was freaking out. I was like, what am I going to do? You know, like, and I started thinking, like, are we going to have to go back to Guatemala? So it was scary.
Court battles have kept DACA alive to an extent, but now the Supreme Court is stepping in and there's no clear outcome. Angela is riding out the uncertainty in California. She has her own family now. Her husband has DACA too. Their little boy, he's 4, was born here. And we met at their apartment near San Francisco.
What's the name of that one, do you know?
Dinosaur Tower, actually.
Oh, Dinosaur Tower.
Angela tries to avoid the news about immigration. It's too stressful. In fact, she prefers not to talk to anyone about immigration, not friends or colleagues.
Even here in California, you never know who's against it and who's not. So it's really hard to talk about it because you're not certain of people's opinions.
Her sister Karen, though, she was done with being anxious about DACA and about her husband's status. He's undocumented.
I eventually want to have kids, you know, and I couldn't see that happening in the States the way our situation was. Because, like, and worrying all the time that, like, one day I might not be able to work and then my husband's going to be deported.
So Karen made a big decision.
I came over to my parents' house and we sat down and we had dinner and I told them that we were going to move to Canada.
Karen had done some research and found out that with her skills and college degrees, she could become a legal resident in Canada pretty quickly. Now she and her husband live in Vancouver. Karen works as a data analyst at a healthcare company. And in some ways, she sees herself in her parents. They moved to the U.S. for a better life. Now, she's left the U.S. for similar reasons, but she can't go back to the U.S., not until she gets a tourist visa or a Canadian passport.
It's very hard. You worry, you know, that something might happen and you won't be there. I knew that was gonna be a possibility, but, like, I needed to think about my own future. I know it might sound like a bit selfish, I guess.
Karen's mom, Clara, doesn't think her daughter is being selfish.
Para eso las prepara uno, para que vuelen con sus propias alas.
She says that's what you prepare your kids to do, to fly with their own wings. I met Clara at her home in East Palo Alto. She keeps her phone close.
En la mañana nos saludamos, buenos días, ¿cómo está? Y a mediodía también hablamos. Y en la noche nos miramos por video.
She says she's in touch with Karen throughout the day, texting, calling, and that makes things easier. But Karen's move has been hard on her sister, Angela, too.
You know, we've always been a close family, and we had never been apart.
Now, the family's working to get Clara and their dad legal status in the U.S. They're both undocumented, no DACA, nothing. Clara asked to use her first name only because of her lack of legal status.
Nosotros tratamos de vivir el día a día. Mi esposo trabaja. No sabemos, como le digo yo a mis hijas, de aquí a la tienda.
Clara says she lives day to day here in the U.S. It's a risk just to go to the store on the corner, she says. She's that worried about deportation. But she's determined to stay here and have all of her family, all her kids, in one spot in the same country again one day. For The World, Monica Campbell, East Palo Alto.
And now let's turn to that Supreme Court case over DACA. In court tomorrow, the Trump administration will argue that it has the right to end the DACA program, and lawyers for DACA recipients will make the counterargument. My colleagues Carol Hills and The World's immigration reporter Tanya Karas talk through what the case is all about.
So, Tanya, first things first, just remind us succinctly what DACA is.
So DACA is a program that has been around since 2012. It stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It is a legal program that exists for undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children, and more than 800,000 of them have benefited from the program. It gives them work permits, and it also allows them the ability to get driver's licenses and health insurance.
And does it provide them a way to apply for green cards or permanent citizenship?
No, it does not. It is not a pathway to permanent residency or citizenship. It is merely just allowing them to be here without the threat of deportation for 2 years at a time. But the program itself was always meant to be an interim measure.
So this case has been in legal limbo for a while now. Remind us how we got here.
In 2017, the Trump administration began rolling back the program. It ordered the Department of Homeland Security to stop taking new applications, which it did stop doing. And it also ordered that current DACA statuses not be renewed. And that was challenged immediately by the lower courts. And a judge ordered the Trump administration to restart the renewals. And some of those challenges are what we are going to be hearing tomorrow at the Supreme Court.
What decision does the court have to make?
They'll be looking at two legal questions. The first question is whether the courts even have jurisdiction to review DACA in the first place. And the Trump administration is arguing that reviewing this case is outside the jurisdiction of the court.
Okay, so the first thing the court needs to rule on is whether the court, the Supreme Court, or any court has the legal standing to rule on DACA. What's the second thing the Supreme Court needs to decide?
The second thing is whether the Trump administration's termination of DACA is lawful or not. They probably won't actually get to the question of whether DACA itself is legal or not. That's not the question before the Supreme Court. They're only going to be looking at whether the termination is lawful or unlawful.
And what are the possible answers the court could give?
If the justices ruled that the termination is unlawful, that is a big win for DACA recipients because it basically turns back the clock to the day before the Trump administration announced it was ending the program. And if the justices ruled that the termination was lawful, then it's up to the Trump administration to decide how it'll continue winding down the program.
So for anyone who's currently a DACA recipient, what does the Supreme Court's decision, which we won't hear probably until June, what will that mean for them?
It's really, really unclear. The fate of the program, it really just depends on which way the justices rule and what legal reasoning they use. And like you said, we're probably not going to find that out until June of 2020. And so in the meantime, what happens with things like pending applications and work permits for DACA recipients, all of that is kind of in limbo until we finally hear from the court. And so that's why they have been kind of holding their breath for the last 2 years. They will be holding their breath for another several months longer until the court tells us what the fate of the program will be.
Those were my colleagues, immigration reporter Tanya Karas and Carol Hills, explaining the U.S. Supreme Court case on DACA. The court will hear oral arguments tomorrow. At the court, to watch the session unfold, will be Norma Ramirez. She's one of the plaintiffs, and we'll speak with her tomorrow here on The World. Turkey says it's starting to deport foreign members of ISIS held in Turkish prisons. Most of the detainees are from European countries, but there is one American citizen on the list. A Turkish official said the country is not a hotel for foreign jihadis. The goal here is to eventually repatriate about 2,500 militants back to their home countries. But that might cause some diplomatic friction with European nations because of the legal complications that could follow. Anne Speckhard is the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. She joins us from Washington.
I've interviewed 211 ISIS cadres, most of them in prisons in Iraq and Syria, and most have given their permission to have their interview shared with their home government because they're hoping that their government will take them home and they know they're going to face prosecution. So I've been working with a number of EU governments directly and Australia as well to try to get these people repatriated. No country wants to take them back, particularly the male fighters, if they're not prosecuted, if they don't spend time in prison, because, you know, they're afraid. They're afraid that they'll take them back and they'll end up on the streets and that they'll be a danger.
So you're saying these countries from which these ISIS fighters came, those countries want fighters to stay in Turkey, to be tried there and serve time there?
Well, most of the EU countries don't want to take their ISIS prisoners back. They're worried that they can't successfully prosecute them. You know, it's hard to get evidence that will hold up in court from an active war zone. So if they can't prosecute them and they're not confident that they can put them in prison and hopefully in some kind of rehabilitation program, they're terrified. Each country has their own concerns. France is really worried about a prison radicalization problem. Sweden has a problem because they don't have good counterterrorism laws to be able to prosecute these people.
What about the United States? Is the U.S. in a similar situation?
No, we're really lucky that we haven't had so many people resonate to the ISIS call. And then we can also be really proud that we have a robust legal system. So we've taken everybody back. They're charged and they go through a legal proceeding.
Turkey has criticized European countries in the past for refusing to take back their foreign nationals held in Turkish prisons. So why do you think that Turkey seems to be taking repatriation into its own hands now?
I think that the timing is really interesting. I think he's flexing his muscles and telling Europe, I've got these people and I can send them back anytime I want. Turkey has immense power over Europe because if Turkey wants to, they can allow all the refugees in Turkey to stream into Europe. The EU understands this and they'll probably play ball with whatever Erdogan demands. In The Guardian, it says there's 2,500 people to go back to Europe from Turkey. So this is a huge number of people for Europeans to suddenly have to deal with, and they're not ready.
You know, countries like Denmark and the UK have actually stripped people of their citizenship for involvement in terrorist groups. What happens to those people if they're sent back? I mean, can you actually be prosecuted if you're technically stateless?
In the case of the UK, they've only stripped citizenship from people that had a second citizenship or that were eligible. So EU countries shouldn't be stripping people and making them stateless, because if they are doing that, they're violating international law.
I mean, it sounds like there's quite a bit of confusion and unanswered questions about process, and then that process is probably going to depend on individual countries. In the meantime, this repatriation, is it just going to be Turkey putting detainees on a plane and just sending them back? And then what?
I don't know. You know, it may just be bluster for this week. Erdogan's coming to meet with Trump, and this is a bonding point with Trump. Look, I'm parroting your words. I'm saying the same thing to Europe. I'm standing up to Europe. But will he actually do mass deportations of 2,500 people, most of whom Turkey's claiming are from the EU? I don't know. And if he does, I imagine a country can refuse to land a plane. You know, it remains to be seen.
That's Anne Speckhard, director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. If you were a newish parent or a kid in the late 90s, this might sound familiar.
Mail time.
Mail time. The mail's here. Come on.
Mail time on Blue's Clues, the kid show on Nickelodeon, about a blue-spotted dog who leaves paw prints as clues for her friends. The original host, Steve Burns, wore a striped green rugby shirt, charismatic young man with a lot of side eye. Who can forget him? Blue's Clues ended its original run in 2006, but making his debut today in the reboot, Blue's Clues and You, is Josh De La Cruz. So you're the new host, Josh. Congratulations. How are you feeling about the premiere?
Thank you so much. It's exciting. We've been working on the show for about a year now, and it's exciting to finally have it come out and have people watch it and get to know Blue.
So you're the first Asian American on the show. You're Filipino American. When you were announced as host last year, Josh, many Asian Americans took to social media and said, yeah, big thumbs up. How did you feel about that support?
I'm so honored. I never thought about being in this position. I never thought about working in children's television, and I never thought that I would really be anyone that anybody looked up to in any sense of the word. You know, I just try to do my best on a day-to-day. But getting this opportunity to represent a demographic that doesn't usually get a lot of screen time in a non-threatening foreigner way means a lot to me. My favorite thing that I've heard so far is from friends and their kids or their coworkers' kids is that he looks like me. And that's something that I never really experienced growing up, especially in a children's show. And, you know, I think that maybe shut off some doors to me in my mind because I never saw myself represented. Mm. And so I never thought like, oh, I'd love to work on the show one day. It was so important to my childhood. I would love to return that favor.
So I got to say, you watched Blue's Clues as a kid. I watched it as a parent. And many parents, having spoken with a lot of parents about this, they love the show because Steve was a draw. He was kind of the draw. He had great presence and timing. Does it feel like you can be yourself with Blue's Clues in you? Or do you feel somehow driven to capture what Steve had?
I think as hard as I would try, I'll never be Steve Burns just because I am who I am. And that was definitely a worry when I found out that I got the job, even when I was auditioning. One of the most helpful things that happened is that Steve Burns pulled me aside during a work session before we ever got to set. And he said, I just want to let you know, I just wanted to tell you personally that we hired you because we love you and we love what you do. And we don't ever want you to feel any kind of pressure to try and do anything that I or Dono, who played Joe, his brother, anything that we did, you can totally be yourself. This is your house now. It was those words that really gave me permission and really the confidence.
That is so cool of him to say that.
Oh my gosh. You know, when I first met him, I was terrified. But then he opened his mouth and in person, he has such a resonant voice. And, you know, it's like James Earl Jones saying, Luke, I'm your father. but he goes, hey, man. And I was transported to when I was watching the show with my little sister, and I felt important. I felt like I was meant to be there. And he is that presence in real life when he's talking to you. He just hands over the power, and I hope that I can do that for an entire new generation of kids.
So you're the only human on the show. Does that make an even bigger responsibility for you connecting with those kids?
You know, it's so funny because the home viewer is the main character. They are the entire focus of the show. And everything in our script, every piece of animation, every color, every game, every note that I get about my performance comes from a childhood development background and because they want to help kids. Which is why I think they updated the name to Blue's Clues and You, because it's just as interactive as it was when it premiered in 96. But the emphasis is really on the home viewer, because I personally can't move forward without their help, without them talking to me on screen.
Well, congratulations again, Josh De La Cruz, the host of Blue's Clues and You, premiering today on Nickelodeon. Thanks for being with us, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
We don't really do celebrity journalism on the show, but our next story actually ventures into that territory. Here's The World's Amanda McGowan.
Nothing says feline contentment like a good, rolling purr. Like many cats, Bilbo can be expressive. Unlike many cats, he has a big platform with his own podcast. It's called The Bilbcast, and in each episode, Bilbo purrs continuously for 30 minutes straight.
Bilbo is a 5-year-old orange boy. He's very loving. He's very affectionate. He's quite big. He's actually not plump, but he does have big jowls, so he's got a very round and delightful head.
That's Ellen Murray, Bilbo's owner and podcast co-presenter. She's the executive director of Transgender NI, a trans rights organization in Belfast, Northern Ireland. She also works on disability rights and accessibility issues. It's work that she loves, but it can be heavy, intellectually and emotionally. Bilbo helps her relax and recharge.
Being able to just turn that off and not think about it for a while, to share the love that this creature is showing towards you, to other people, and to see the responses that people send in return is wonderful.
Ellen says that's what draws other people to the podcast too. It's an escape.
The world can be horrible. Twitter can be horrible. Modern life can be horrible. And seeing a silly cat, just going about his life, can help with that in a small way.
Bilbo the Cat has thousands of podcast listeners and nearly 75,000 followers on Twitter. Alan says they're using his celebrity status for something bigger. He lent his famous purring to a fundraising campaign for Mermaids UK, a charity for transgender children and their families. And in January, a motion was submitted in Scotland's Parliament to recognize Bilbo's contribution. Seriously.
He was acknowledged as two of the celebrities who'd appeared, the other one being Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Not too shabby, being name-checked as a rising star alongside AOC. But Ellen says she's just happy that Bilbo's naturally affectionate personality has resonated with so many people.
It's a space which uses the vector of love to do a lot. And that's something that can be difficult to find elsewhere, offline and online.
A big, furry, orange vector of love. For the World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
Now that is a purring sound you can meditate to. Check out photos of Bilbo the Cat on our Instagram. We are at PRI The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.